Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is part two of episode 43 with John Ronson. I hope you enjoyed the first half. He's one of the most fascinating guys and interesting dudes. As you will have heard, his book, Them, blew me away and was actually weirdly important in my career, memories-wise, I mean. It was my first ever at Glastonbury and it was raining and then ended up sitting in my 1987 Toyota Space Cruiser feeling kind of guilty about the fact that I wasn't out there partying, but reading this amazing book. It was great to have him on. I have to mention again, I know I've mentioned it previously and you're going to have adverts dropped in and out all over the place, but these are people who sponsor us and support the show, and this is how we keep it free for you. So please support and help them out. Squarespace, on it, you know, we've had loads. And of course, Speech Development Records, that's a record label. You can head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. to buy general merch, DVDs, all sorts of stuff. The Edinburgh Fringe show where John Ronson and his son Joel came along to. And as far as I know, thoroughly enjoyed. You can get that. Also, there's exclusive Distraction Pieces merch, but it's not even just in the normal web store because I wanted it hidden from everyone who isn't a regular listener. So it's at teamfreew.distractionpiecespodcast.com. You have to go to a secret portal to support that. So thank you very much. Let's go on with part two. He continues with the story of the superhero, and it's fascinating. All of it's fascinating. So yeah, I'll be back at the end. So until then, this is Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 43, part two, with John Ronson. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And now that shortly has gone, and we'll continue now.
Hello.
So yeah, we're back. How was that with a superhero then? In that, literally have left a cliffhanger and continue on from in part two.
This was the last. I mean, unless you count being screamed at by thousands of people on Twitter, dangerous. Yeah. This was the last dangerous thing that I did. And I sort of thought, I'm going to retire from doing really dangerous things because this was fucking terrifying. So
where was it?
It was about 3 years ago.
Right.
And I was in Seattle with this real-life superhero called Felix Jones, who goes out every night to try and thwart crime.
Yeah. Costumed or?
Very costumed.
Very costumed.
Yeah, black and gold.
Amazing.
With like bulletproof vest and mask. He's been unmasked now.
Oh, wow.
But he hadn't been unmasked when I was with him. So his real name's Ben Foda.
Right.
But nobody knew that at the time.
Yeah.
So the problem with Phoenix was that unlike some cops, mm-hmm. when he got really frustrated when there wasn't any crime to thwart.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, it was like he was a little bit too in love with thwarting crime.
Yeah, that's not good.
And when I was with him, there was very little crime to thwart. At one point, he saw these two men talking and one drops something on the ground and Phoenix went, Yahtzee, and started running towards them thinking it was like a drug deal. And then he got to the guys, he goes, what did you drop on the ground, sir? And the guy said, some pretzels. So that Phoenix was like really frustrated and disappointed that it was pretzels and not crack.
Just too up for some trouble.
Yeah. And then we broke up a gang of crack addicts at a bus stop.
Yeah.
These, you know, sad, tired looking people at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Phoenix and his fellow superheroes were like standing a little distance off, whispering to each other. And the crack addicts were looking back at them and thinking, what are these guys saying to each other?
What's going on?
Yeah, and do you know what they were actually saying to each other? Right. One of them said to the other, I love your colour scheme. I love the black and gold.
It's why we can't have real superheroes. It's just not, it's never going to be for the right reasons and in the right ways. It's bizarre.
You went, thank you very much. I got this done specially made. I had a costumier. So whatever, they've done a beautiful job. The gold really pops.
Amazing.
Someone actually said those words, the gold really pops.
Amazing.
So then the crack addicts scattered. And that made me feel terrible actually.
Yeah.
you know, these poor people. I mean, there was like, this was 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
There was like no one around. It's like leaving the fuck alone, you know? So.
Yeah, it's a difference, isn't it? It's again a crime that isn't a crime against anyone else other than themselves, essentially. Yeah. So it's weird that it's a criminal act.
I felt very bad for them, and I felt like Phoenix was just like interfering in their
just
lives,
hassling,
like dogs chasing a fox.
So but
then what happened was, on the last night, Phoenix was like so frustrated that I hadn't seen any proper action. He decided to go to, he was going to take me to Belltown.
Yeah.
So I didn't know anything about Belltown. You know, I'm not from Seattle.
I was going to say, do you think your presence influenced it much?
Clearly it did.
The fact that that want to prove to a journalist that, look, we do tough stuff.
Yeah. This was a big story for them. It was like a big story in American GQ. And sure enough, it became like a big story.
Yeah.
It went viral and stuff.
Yeah.
It was for American GQ. So we go to Belltown at like 3 a.m, and there's about 30 crack. Because I thought, okay, crack, you know, we broke up a gang of crack addicts, that wasn't scary.
Mm.
Now we're going to break up a gang of crack dealers, that's not going to be scary. I forgot that like crack addicts and crack dealers are two very different
people. Very different worlds,
So we got to Belltown, and there's like 30 people staring at us, saying, not unreasonably, what the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah.
Coming into our community in your stupid costumes.
Yeah, I do not appreciate the colour scheme. And the gold does not pop for me.
Yeah. And then one of them said to Phoenix, you know, how you feed your family is not how we feed our family.
Yeah.
This may be fun and games to you, but it's not fun and games to us.
Damn.
So what I was doing, of course, was nodding in agreement with everything the crack dealers were saying, in the hope that if the shooting started, they'd like considerately shoot around me.
Yeah.
And then they said, their specific words were, if you stay around on our block, we're going to show you what the burner do.
Mm.
So I'm like, I'm sure I remember from The Wire that a burner is a stolen mobile phone, but that doesn't sound contextually right.
No.
So then they walked away, and I said to Phoenix, what's a burner? And Phoenix said, it's a gun.
Yeah.
So then one of them comes round, like they're all standing at the top of the road, and then one of them comes round and walks past us. And I can't remember his exact words, but as he carries on walking, he basically says, if you don't leave our block now, we're going to kill you. And then just circled round and goes back to the group. Phoenix was like, are we staying or are we leaving? And Phoenix's fellow superhero said, we're staying. And then to make things worse...
Damn, that's not the words you wanted to hear at that point, was it?
No, really not. To make things even worse, there was a parked car right next to us with a cigarette packet under the windscreen wiper.
Hmm.
And Phoenix said, that's a sign that crack is sold here. So what I'm going to do is take this cigarette packet and rip it up and put it on the floor. So that's what he did. So then they all started walking towards us.
Yeah.
Like about, I don't know, 15, 20 people. And, you know, they had their hands down their sweatpants. And then as they got to us, they said to Phoenix, are you really willing to die for this shit?
Hmm.
And Phoenix said something like, yes, I am, sir. And they said, well, if you're really willing to die for this, I guess we're going to have to go home. We should shoot you, but we're going to go home. And then they all left. Yeah, they all left.
Damn. Yeah. Are what reasonable and controlled crack dealers.
Weren't they?
The fact that they asked, are you really willing to die for this as well, I think, is as much of a great insight into the fact that these are humans. As you said, they're feeding their families. They're not actually out there thinking, I want to kill everyone in sight.
Yeah.
Or necessarily. They're like, well, you know.
It was an amazing thing to witness. I mean, like, really frightening at the time, but really an incredible thing to witness. Phoenix said, so they all departed. Phoenix said, we're going to stay around here for the next hour or so to consolidate the block. Do you want to wait with us? And I said, no, I do not.
I'm done, thank you.
Yeah, so I went back to the hotel. And as I got into my hotel room, my knees buckled and I had to sort of hold onto a table to keep myself up.
I can imagine. Yeah. Intense.
Phoenix phoned me about an hour or two later and he was sounding so hyper. You know, he was so hyper because of everything. I think it was all like, you know, it was all that the adrenaline was just going crazy with him.
Yeah, of course. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow, what an experience. Yeah.
But as I got back to my hotel, it was like 5 a.m. when I got back to my hotel and I did think to myself, you know, I'm too old for this now.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I must have been, it's about 3 years ago, so I was like kind of, you know, 44, 45, and I just thought, you know, I can't do this anymore.
Can't be doing this.
Yeah.
And such an odd, a weird situation, I'd imagine you become frozen in it essentially because I'd imagine there would be a thought at points of do I stick around, and like when they're saying are you willing to die for this or wanting to put your hand up and go excuse me, I'm not so I'll just over here, you know. So again, an amazing thing there to stick through that and then and then leave.
But there was nothing, I mean, you know, there was nothing brave in my behaviour because I had no idea that this was
going to go there.
Yeah, that this is what Phoenix was taking me into.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
That's crazy. Let's talk about the man who stare at goats, because that was, I read that enthusiastically after them and loved it as well.
Thank you.
How was that? That was looking heavily into the bizarreness of the military industry, essentially, and the paranormal area, or I don't know, the research into paranormal powers, or just
we stumbled on it by incredible good fortune, actually.
Yeah.
After 2 years of really flailing around, not knowing what the fuck to do, after them, Channel 4, because I made a documentary series to go with them called Secret Rulers of the World, and Channel 4 said something that like no one's ever said to me before or after, which was, here's like a whole load of money. Like they liked Secret Rulers of the World. Here's like, you know, £400,000. Go and make us like 3 or 4 more films similar to Secret Rulers.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, you know, I don't know. I've got no ideas. You know, I don't know. And my producer Fenton was like, you know, this people never, you know, channels never do this. You have to take the money.
You've got to take this.
Yeah.
It's a weird a thing, right, when you're like, well, it's nice of you,
but
I don't know what,
and it could fail, and it nearly failed, like really nearly failed. In Channel 4's eyes, I think it kind of did fail, because what happened was, so we spent some of the money trying to prove that George Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, had grave robbed Geronimo's grave and stolen his skull.
Right,
which,
amazing.
By the way, when he was like a World War One soldier, which, by the way, might be true.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find a way of proving it.
Couldn't prove it.
So we spent a whole bunch of money failing to do that. And then a few other stories that we tried to do and failed to do.
Yeah.
And I was starting to really panic.
You see, that's a weird thing. And I've had experience of this on with different, when I've been in talks with different TV channels about things, is I don't believe that failing to prove something means a failed project. And again, there's always that need with TV and production companies that there has to be the resolution at the end. I think often it can be, well, here's the journey we've gone on, and there's not a nice tidy.
Yeah.
Here's the summation. Because I think that can be as important in research in all sorts of things as having this clean tidy. Right, we've solved that problem. On to the next one, in non-fiction, you know, in fiction, obviously you need that, but in non-fiction, I think it can be a beautiful thing to just go on that journey and do what you can.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
But we were still fucking up.
Yeah.
So then my producer at the time, John Sargent, said, why don't we do remote viewing? And remote viewing was this thing that people already knew. People had known this for about 6 or 7 years at that point, that the CIA had a team of secret psychic spies that were inside some room at some army base trying to be psychic. And the reason why people knew is because this guy called Jim Schnabel had brought out a book called Remote Viewing.
Yeah.
And so my instinct was like, well, someone's already done this story.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the fuck to do. And Channel 4 massively running out of patience with us.
So
we'll give it a try.
Got something, yeah.
Yeah, so I went to meet a couple of the remote viewers, Joe McMonagall and Ed Dames and one or two others. And I've got to say, I wasn't really enthusiastic about it. It was like, A, someone had already done the story, and B, their lives sound amazing, secret psychic spies working for the US military, but actually they were just sitting in a fucking room. Sitting in a room fucking thinking and sketching shit down. And it was boring.
Yeah.
And there
it probably felt like a solid paragraph rather than
exactly.
A full, you know.
There was some fun to be had with like this sort of fantasy of what you imagine being a kind of black ops psychic spy is, you know, versus the reality, which was that they had no coffee machine. And, you know, so there was some fun to be had that. But I couldn't think where to go after that. So I was sort of like at a really low ebb. And then we were interviewing this guy. And this has definitely been, like, the best interview of... Well, like, the interview that opened up more doors than any other interview that I've ever done.
Right.
So I was in Las Vegas interviewing this guy called Ray Hyman, who's, like, a skeptic and a magician, and his whole thing is, like, debunking the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that he had been brought in by the CIA to assess the psychics because they were wondering whether to carry on with the program or shutting it down. So I was interviewing Ray Hyman, and about halfway through the interview, I just said to him, you know, when you were like assessing the psychic spies and you were like inside the CIA, you didn't happen to notice like anything else going on, did you? And this sort of look crossed his face, a sort of twinkle, and he went, yeah, he said there was this general called Stubblebine who thought he was like a major general in charge of like tens of thousands of soldiers, and he thought he could burst clouds just by pointing at them. And he said, and there was this colonel, this lieutenant colonel called Channon, who was training his soldiers to eat only nuts and grains for a month. And he said, but I can't remember anything else. So at the end
suddenly,
of the interview, I thought, okay, we've got these two names now, Stubblebine and Channon. And the whole fucking bizarre Ministeric Goat story.
Yeah.
Then trying to kill goats just by staring at them and all of the shit. General Stubblebine trying to walk through his wall and just bumping his nose.
Yeah.
All of that came from like me then saying to John Sargent at the end of the interview, let's try and find Stubblebine and Channon. We've got these two names.
Yeah.
So that one question, you know,
just opened it all up.
Just opened up fucking, you know, that there was the whole, that the George Clooney movie and the book, all of that came from me just asking Ray Hyman that one question.
Yeah, amazing. And did you have much involvement in the movie?
No. Peter Strawn, who I've subsequently become really good friends with, he wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
And it was his screenplay that got everyone interested.
That got them involved, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know some people like the movie, some people don't, but what's beyond doubt is Peter is a brilliant, brilliant screenwriter. He's just, he just did Wolf Hall, you know, the TV adaptation. And, you know, he's so brilliant and people loved his screenplay. And, and I wrote Frank with him.
Yeah.
We co-wrote Frank together. So...
You see, that's what I've enjoyed with both the Ministeric Goats, and Frank, is neither have been what I was expecting at all.
Mm-hmm.
I thoroughly enjoyed them, but having read the book and then watching the film, I was like, all right, that wasn't what I thought it was going to be for some reason. And Frank was the same. I went in expecting something and it was a film I thoroughly enjoyed, but I was sitting the whole time thinking, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. This isn't what I thought it was going to be at
Nor
all.
Nor me, actually. I mean, I definitely wrote a more sort of broad comedy, I'd say. Than the way Lenny directed it. Lenny made it much more sort of melancholy. And, Lenny was really influenced, I think, by like Scandinavian directors and that guy whose name I can't remember, which means I was probably sexually abused by him.
Probably,
the guy who did Leningrad Cowboys Go America. Can't remember his name.
Can't think, no.
Yeah. But like sort of, you know, absurdist art comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
So Lenny brought all of that sort of feel to the film, which a lot of people really love.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was great. I loved that whole side of
really
it and the tone of it. And, but again, as I said, in many ways, I wish I'd watched it having no knowledge of who Frank Sidebottom was. And do you know what I mean? The amount of almost baggage I brought with me.
Yeah.
You know, made me have to fight to enjoy it as much as I did. If you know what I mean. Do you know what I mean? I don't mean that in a bad way at all.
No, it was very enjoyable.
I totally know what you mean.
Well, I've got to say, I mean, that was a thing with me. It was like how much, like, if you don't mention that this film is inspired by Frank Sidebottom, you're doing his memory and his legacy a disservice.
Yeah.
But if you mention it too much, people are going to get, like, the wrong idea.
Expecting it to be
a film about Frank Sidebottom. Yeah, so it was a difficult position, actually. Yeah. I mean, I really strongly felt that to sort of deny that this film was inspired by Frank Sidebottom would be a really, you know, poor thing to do.
So I made
a big effort, like, to constantly remind people that this film, you know, isn't a biopic, but wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for Frank Sidebottom.
Yeah, of course.
But it's true. Like you said, I think it kind of gave people the wrong idea about the film. But, you know, you make up your own rules as you go along, your own sort of moral rules.
And that was my moral rule.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about the psychopath test? And there's a specific part that I started to quote in a previous podcast, couldn't really remember the details well enough, so I vaguely went into it. But it was the bit where you were talking about the TV shows, like your Jeremy Kyles or whatever, the level of mental illness, essentially, that they look for, the particular types of medication that they look for.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that a bit? Because that was just fascinating.
So it was an informal idea that a researcher, a guest booker for one of these shows had, a woman called Charlotte. She doesn't work for those shows anymore, and she's in a way a kind of whistleblower now. Mm. So this wasn't like formal policy.
Yeah, it wasn't here's the policy, right. It was
her thing. But what it was that she had this special trick that she would utilise when deciding which guests to book, and it was that she would ask them what medication they were on. And if it was like a sort of scary-sounding medication like lithium, I mean, this is very unscientific, she said, it wouldn't want to have them on the show, because what you don't want is them to go on the show and then go off and kill themselves. Mm-hmm. She said, but if it was a great story, you know, like a far-reaching family drama where, like, generations of a family hate each other and are going to scream at each other on TV, even if they are on lithium, you know, you're still going to have them on.
You'll still give that a go.
Yeah. And she said sometimes they do fuck up. Like one time, this is such a chilling story, she said one time they did this show about the world's craziest bodybuilders.
Yeah.
And so she had this guy on who was a crazy bodybuilder. And then after the show, he phoned her up. And while he was on the phone to her, he slit his wrists.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is another reason, going back to what we talked about before, Rachel Dolezal, it's like, you know, when you're monkeying around with people's lives,
they're real humans.
Yeah. You don't know about this woman. You know, you don't know if it's body dysmorphia, which is what this guy had.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he had body dysmorphia.
I mean, the most chilling example of that was in the book, which is a story I didn't know of the TV, the makeover show in America.
Yeah.
I'm sure you'll tell that better than me.
God, you know, I haven't told that story since the book came out, so I don't remember all of the details, but it was a similar story about this girl.
From my memory of it, it was a makeover show where
they were going to make her a beautiful
It's a plastic surgery type thing, so they pay for plastic surgery turn you into this
God,
person.
You're right. But it didn't fit the schedule of the show, so she never got the plastic surgery. And then she watches all of, like, a mother
so she
and
got
her
shown,
sister.
And again, the mother and sister, because I looked into the case more after it, the mother and sister maintained that they were coaxed by the production company to be more.
Yeah,
well, just, it was always embarrassing having her, you know, because she looks so different and all that, and kind of to over-egg it, because the reality is they're getting thousands of pounds worth of plastic surgery for her. It's this seemingly beautiful thing in their minds. And then, so she saw, they had the bit where she watches, or, you know, watches everyone saying how hideous
ugly
she is.
Was.
And then it didn't fit the schedule, so she didn't get, she wasn't going to be using the series, therefore didn't get the plastic surgery.
That's right. And then the sister, am I right, and I mean, my memory isn't great, but am I right in thinking that then the sister, the one who said, you know, my sister's so ugly, I can't wait for her to get the plastic surgery, she killed herself, or did the girl kill herself?
I thought it was the girl had killed herself.
I remember one of the two sisters killed themselves.
In my remembering of the story, which, again, we can link to on Acast, is that she killed herself, and then the mum and the sister were rallying against the production company, because saying, look, this is because essentially you've got her nearest and dearest to slag her off, talk about all her imperfections, and then not do the resolution bit, not do the bit where you turn them into a beautiful princess.
Because
you
leave they realised that the plastic surgery would take, because the plastic surgery was going to take a couple of weeks, and they only had like a week in the budget.
Yeah,
that's right.
So horrendous.
But to finish Charlotte's story, so if they were on a medication, like a fun-sounding medication like Prozac, that's perfect.
Then they're perfect because they're likely to be have an entertaining episode as such. She said, you don't, episode in the episode.
She said, you don't want real exploitation, you want smoke and mirrors exploitation, which is something I have over and over again, you know, I noticed that. It's that I think it's the reason why we demonise people on social media so much is because, you know, we call them, you know, Rachel Dolezal, well, she's obviously a psychopath. It's like, you know, people use those words because they're dehumanising words. You want to, because you don't want real exploitation, you want smoke and mirrors exploitation. You want to destroy people but not feel bad about it.
Yeah, yeah, completely. We did, I had a podcast out last week where it was kind of exactly about that, the humanising of the dehumanised. I sat down and spoke to a refugee who's had an amazing story and a hideous experience in the UK as well as in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But in this day and age, with the recent elections and all that, it's become such a thing that just there's just immigrants and there's illegal immigrants and there's this and that and there's not actual humans there. And the point of that, I think, and again, I think that's something particularly with a social networking, because even when it is individual humans, they're behind some kind of screen and guise, so you don't feel that association. And it's something, again, people say stuff on social media that they would never say to someone in real life or to their face, and it's that weird thing of getting that distance from everyone.
The drone strike operator doesn't need to feel responsible for the village that was just blown up.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and obviously some people deserve it more than others. I mean, you know, no two transgressions are of the same level of severity. But
true.
Yeah, but I think the problem is that, you know, when destruction is the knee-jerk response to any transgression, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, we'll start to wrap things up shortly. Just quickly, as we've only just touched on the psychopath test, really, can you kind of say why that became an interest for you and what your feeling was at the end of it? Because, again, briefly, there's a test, a series of questions to define
whether someone's a psychopath.
Whether or not you're a psychopath.
And I did the course.
Yeah.
And became just drunk with my psychopath spotting powers.
You just find them everywhere.
Find them everywhere. And then luckily, I mean, I'm cutting
a
long story short.
Thing as well, because I found again in reading it that it's one of them things that there's probably one or two things in that checklist that most people will register for.
Yeah.
But where you've now become so akin to it, you're then noticing that one thing and assuming the rest. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Or you can then assume that they're covering up a certain amount and this and that.
Yeah. Man's need for stimulation, proneness to boredom.
Right.
But there is a line in the book where I say, because somebody, you know, a psychiatrist says it to me, if you're worried that you may be a psychopath, that means you're not one.
Yeah.
Because they never worry about it. Because what's there to worry about? It's a pleasant feeling, mental disorder.
You see, forgetting that now makes me concerned that at the start of the first episode, I was saying, you know, I had some feelings of it. I wasn't particularly worried about it. I kind of felt like, all right, great. That flags me
as definitely
a psychopath.
So then... You know, I just got mired in my psychopath spotting abilities.
Yes.
I would spot psychopaths everywhere. I remember at the time there was a woman on Twitter who was like causing me some trouble, a bit stalkery, and I was a bit alarmed by it.
Mm.
And I talked to like an eminent psychiatrist who's like involved in the psychopath field.
Yeah.
And I told him like a couple of things about this woman. And he went, definitely a psychopath, no question, definitely. And I said, yeah, definitely. And she's not. She's scary, a perfectly, yeah. She's a delightful young lady. You know, just
scary, isn't it, how quickly that can be.
And this was somebody with the power of diagnosis. I mean, yeah. Obviously he was saying this to me informally in an interview situation, and he wasn't about to have her locked up.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, that's indicative, right?
Completely. And
I don't put any of that in the book, by the way. But that's when I began to feel... fuck, you know, maybe having this power can turn you a bit psychopathic.
Yeah, another thing that really made me instantly drawn into the psychopath test was, and my favourite film of all time is Harvey, with Jimmy Stewart, and I think it's bizarrely become so relevant again in today's society, because it's essentially about the overdiagnosis of anything, of saying, right, he's just of slight differences, and, you know, saying that because that person's different, therefore they should be locked up or they should be medicated. And there was a lot of fascinating stuff towards the start of the over-medication, particularly of children in America.
As young as 2 and 3 are getting diagnosed. It's not happening quite so much now because there were deaths.
Yeah.
But it took deaths, you know, getting diagnosed as bipolar.
Yeah.
Because they had temper tantrums. And that's on the checklist.
And it's like, well... Yeah. And it was honestly, amazing how big the book had become of different things that you can be diagnosed for. Again, that was just fascinating. It's like
886 pages was DSM-4. DSM-5, I think, is even bigger, actually.
Of different things that can mean you're wrong.
So many. That's crazy, isn't it? Arithmetic learning disorder. A new really bad one. So they got rid of childhood bipolar disorder. Yeah. Actually, childhood bipolar disorder...
I guess it all keeps a looping back to that point of wanting to dehumanise or label something. And I thought also it was a great point when you were saying it's easier for the parents at points to rather than say, oh, Johnny's a bit naughty. It's like, oh, Johnny's got this. Because then it takes the responsibility off of them. And I'm not saying the responsibility should be on them, but do you know what I mean? It alleviates some kind of guilt of I've done something wrong here I'm allowing them to be a naughty kid or an overexcited or... struggle with arithmetic or anything else. So
I totally agree with you. At the same time, I think one shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right, yeah.
Or one shouldn't suffer from throwing out the baby with the bathwater disorder.
Sure.
I still maintain that some, you know, labellings and diagnoses can help, you know.
Yeah.
And some medications help some people in some situations.
Yeah.
So I'm not going all R.D. Lang here, but I did really notice that there were really extreme... Same with this new book, actually. You know, people take really extreme positions on this subject.
Yeah.
It's like if you don't believe... I mean, I'm being a bit extreme here in what I'm about to say. But, you know, I got this sort of sense that if you don't believe in the DSM, you're like a Scientologist. You're like a mental illness denier.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, like the mental illness deniers will say there's no such thing as an anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
It's just not true. Yeah. You know, and obviously the fact is, you know, the truth lies in the middle.
Yeah,
in the unfashionable grey area.
It's fascinating because the argument I always hear tends to be that you don't have depression in tribes, you know, or in these less developed worlds. There's no such thing as all the different depressions and anxieties and whatever that we have. But it's like, but that's because they're very different societies. Mm. If that is the case, it's because they're very different societies.
Yeah.
So doesn't mean it's not real.
Yeah.
That means it's something that has been a product of how we live. We shouldn't just ignore stuff because it's a product of how we live. The rise in cancer is a product of how we live. That shouldn't mean we say, ignore it then.
Right.
It's a product of our society. It's like, that sucks. But, it needs to be addressed and helped and...
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, people have delusions, people hallucinate, people hear voices.
Yeah.
Depression overwhelms some people's lives, anxiety overwhelms some people's lives, no question. But at the same time, you know, there's definitely a fetish for over-labelling and over-diagnosing, and people are making money out of, you know, the over-medicating of children.
And then I think it can become such a strange battle of... almost a battle to wear the badge or to own the badge at points. Mm. And just things that I've seen of people I know who, for example, have ADD, will then be very and quite rightfully at points annoyed that that's become just a saying now, or I'm a bit OCD.
Yeah.
Does it massively affect the quality of your life? I'm a bit OCD, or I'm a bit, and things like that. It's those weird things that have become such a part of our lexicon now that it's a casual a thrown in thing. But then equally, I find it can be a strange thing to be like, well, no, I'm not. It sounds odd, but it feels like a certain hipster element of, well, no, I'm real. I've had OCD for, you know, I had OCD before it was you know what I mean? I think there's some strange level of that as well of then having that, not over pride, because I don't think any of these things should be associated with shame or pride. I don't think that's the situation. But I don't know. There feels something strange there that it can then become an issue, that it's now become a badge of identity for that person and therefore is restrictive in that manner, because they have to fight their own corner constantly to say, no, I really have this.
And it's true.
It becomes self-perpetuating in that manner
And it's why I did this podcast in New York recently called Lit Up. It was good and it was funny. But I remember at one point, I mentioned my anxiety disorder, and a woman interviewed me, Emily Gold. Went, oh, you got anxiety? Okay, I'm just ticking a mark off your privilege. You know, it's like you're not quite as privileged as I thought you were then if you've got anxiety. And she was joking, but it's kind of true, right? It's kind of true.
It's bizarre. Well, I mean, we've done two now, so I should let you go and wind things up. Let's end with what's ahead and what's to plan. Then I'm going to really end with where can people come and argue with you online. But let's go with what's ahead for now.
Okay, well, right now...
And what are you working on?
I'm doing a rewrite on a movie, which is the first time I've ever done that.
Awesome.
This brilliant South Korean director, Bong Joon-ho, was a fan of Frank, so he's got me to rewrite his film called Okja.
It's fascinating. The world of the writer and the rewriter, and something that totally we don't really know as film watchers or film goers, that... So many scripts will get rewrites, will get torn apart, even up to the point where they're being filmed, will be ripped apart, rewritten, restructured. Absolutely. It's a process that we kind of ignore. But
totally new world for me. I didn't like when he asked me to do it, like I met him at a hotel in New York and, you know, I said to him, look, you know, I have limitations. Yeah. Like, A, I've never done this job before. Yeah. I have no idea whether I can do it well. B, I'm good at dialogue and I'm good at comedy, but I'm not good at like massive, or I don't feel confident to say that I'm good at like massive plot twists and narrative arcs and so on. But they offered me the job anyway, and I think I've done it rather well. I'm pleased with it.
Have you enjoyed it? Because again, it must be massively. A fascinating thing to get someone else's work to work with.
I loved it actually. Exactly, because you have to get inside his head, because it's his script. You know, he wrote the first draft. Much of the hard work is already done.
Yeah.
You've got to but he's South Korean and English isn't his first language, so you know it's more stilted for that reason than it would have been. But has the most brilliant. I mean, it's fucking good, and has the most brilliant plot twists and narrative arcs and so on. So what you have to do then is get inside his head. And sort of, this is like a terrible American word that proves I've been in America for 3 years, kind of honour his vision, for want of a better phrase, whilst at the same time adding your own dialogue, changing the characters, you know, but not sort of dishonouring what he's done. So it's almost like doing like a cover version. You know, I felt like I was doing a cover version of his script.
I
loved that. Fucking loved the process.
It's fascinating because it's really, if you look back at our conversation, it's the ideal situation where when Channel 4 came to you and said, here's some money, and you're like, I've not really got any ideas at the moment. The fact is, we know, and you've proven over many years that you can write. Mm. You're a very good writer. So the beauty of then going, well, here's what we need written, essentially. Can you now structure that and make it better? That must be so exciting.
Oh, God, I loved it. I just loved it. And it was easy and such a breath of fresh air, actually, after the Shamed book tour, which was like 12 weeks of really intense stuff. So there's that. And then in the summer, me and Joel, my son, are going off to Los Angeles for all of July. And Joe's going to be doing some podcast
amazing
work, and I'm going to I'm going to write a script on spec. When I was at Sundance with Frank, my co-writer Peter Strawn reminded me that when we were writing Frank, we had this other idea too. And I'd completely forgotten that we had this other idea.
Right.
But then Peter reminded me of what it was.
All right,
and I've written,
get that done.
Yeah, so I wrote about 60 pages and sent it to Peter, and Peter gave me a couple of ideas, and now I'm up to about 90 pages.
Yeah.
And I'm going to spend the summer, you know, just working on that, completely on spec, like no one's waiting for it, no one's expecting it.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah.
That must be a nice...
Yeah, again, that's really nice.
A self-imposed pressure, but it's also the freedom to go, right, let's really allow this.
For 12 weeks, like, we're shamed, like in many countries, in Britain, Ireland, America, Canada, it was like, you know, I'd have a schedule, like 7 in the morning, you've got to be here, like 8, you've got to be here. And it was quite often like 16 hours a day. So I'm really looking forward to just working at my own pace for a few months.
Have you spent a lot of time in LA in the past?
Yeah. I mean, not like this, like not like a month, like we're going to do, but lots of like weeks
here and there.
I really like it. I really romanticise LA. I think it's like a magical place.
For my first chunk of Vidgets, I didn't like it at all. I was like, I don't get it. I don't understand it.
And did you feel
much.
Like isolated?
I felt isolated. I felt completely out of my comfort zone. I felt it wasn't for me. And then now when I go out there and I'm working with people on records and staying with friends, I love it now. It's a wonderful place when you're in that right headspace and you kind of understand it.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. In fact, me and Joel actually were there a couple of weeks ago, and I went and we were staying at the very first hotel I ever stayed at in LA, which was the Hyatt on Sunset in West Hollywood.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I stayed, I was probably about kind of 22, 23, and I was completely on my own. I can't remember what I was doing in LA, but I was completely alone. I didn't know anyone in LA.
Yeah.
And I remember walking up to the ceiling, to the roof terrace of the Hyatt, and looking, and like in all four directions, all you could see is like a sort of sea of light. Like this city as far as the eye can see. I remember thinking, I have never felt so lonely in my life. And I think a lot of people have that experience in LA.
Yeah.
But now that I know people and I know like my favourite places, like I love, you know, hiking on Runyon Canyon and in Griffith Park and Los Feliz.
I've done Runyon a lot of times. I love
Runyon.
View, isn't it?
The great thing about Runyon, especially if you've got like an anxiety disorder, is that there's only one way to go.
It's all the way up and round again.
Like, fuck, am I on the wrong trail? Is there a better trail? Am I going to get lost? Am I on the wrong trail? It's like you can't go wrong. I mean, actually, it can go wrong because I was actually hiking on Runyon with Emmy the Great last summer, and the guy up in front of us died.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so it can go wrong.
Yeah,
that's as wrong as it can go.
Yeah,
right?
And had to be lifted. Like, his body was lifted, winched on a helicopter. And do you know what everyone was doing? Not me and Emmy. Taking photographs for Instagram.
Of course they were. It's insane. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Runyon is an Instagram filter in itself, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
I've
exactly.
seen so many... Everyone I know who lives in LA has posted at least a picture of Runyon, but yeah.
Yeah. But not the body
not
being
of
winched.
Someone being winched off and carried away. Yeah. Man, that
was
bleak.
Really bad. It was a particularly hot day.
Yeah. Take water.
Yeah. Well, you can. There's an honesty box.
Yeah.
Pay a dollar, get some water.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So one time, like I only had $5. So I put the $5 in the box and just took $1.
That's good of you.
And I thought, well, another time, then I'll just take a water for free.
Yeah.
But I was nervous about that. So what I did was I took a water. Like the people around me didn't know that, like, previously I'd put in $5.
Yeah, exactly.
So I pretended to put a dollar in the box. I did the action.
Cover that up just for public perception. You don't want a public shaming,
no,
obviously.
So
where can people keep up with you online? Is Twitter your preferred
social
network?
Not on
website,
Facebook.
Anything like that?
Facebook's just like an app. Yeah, I've got a website. My website is johnronson.com without any H's, just J-O-N, johnronson.com. And my Twitter's johnronson.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute delight.
Scroob, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me. Let's go and wreck your mini bar.
You've been listening to Scroobie's Picks. discretion piece.
There we go. I honestly feel that we could have just talked forever and ever and ever. A fascinating dude with so many stories, and we barely scratched the surface. After we turned off, I talked to him for a good fair while after that, and actually ended up doing his son's podcast, Joel. So keep an eye out for that. He's coming into the podcast in a world. He's a lovely lad. I believe he's going to be interning with Mark Maron in July, I think. So talk about starting out at the top and learning from the best. So yeah, exciting stuff ahead for him, I'm sure. Thank you for tuning in. Please subscribe and all that good stuff. Please tell your friends how awesome this podcast is, because we're growing and growing, and it's all down to you, which is just lovely. So thank you very much for that. We're going to be back next week with the wonderful Mr. Flux Pavilion. Great. If you're not familiar with Flux, amazing producer, dubstep guy. He did a remix of our, or no, he didn't do a remix. He co-produced Gold Teeth with me and Dan Lesac. I'm actually recording this intro just after getting back from recording the podcast with him, and it was amazing. It was fascinating. I love it when we have ones where it's such a specific area, like electronic production. But it was one, again, and I felt this with part one of the Dan Hardy podcast, that whether you're into this or not, it's a fascinating listen. You know, it's an engaging, it's also applicable. Everything we discussed felt very applicable across many different genres, areas, or trades. So yeah, hope you'll enjoy that. I'm on Twitter at ScroobiusPipio and Instagram at ScroobiusPipio and Facebook.com/ScroobiusPip. A lot of people hit me up because I often say, feel free to share your suggestions with who you'd like on the podcast. The best place to do that is on Twitter, and the best way to do that is to tag the person that you're requesting, because again, people seem to have this illusion that I've got a magic black a book of famous people and can hit anyone up. A lot of people on here, either I just happen to know or I hit up via Twitter. So it certainly helps if there's someone that you want on, if you tweet me and tag them in, then, you know, if it's someone I think would fit. And again, I hope people don't be offended if I don't go for your ideas. I try and pick people that I think I can get a good interview out of. It doesn't mean they're not good or I don't like them or you're wrong for liking them. It has to be people I feel I generally have enough of a knowledge of, or enough of a thirst of knowledge to get that information out for you. So yeah, I'm rambling too much now. Thank you for tuning in. See you next week, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.